so give us a try. You can find us at homeschoolheartbeat.com.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I'm really happy to have an old friend and fellow warrior, Marjorie Murphy Campbell, on Church and Culture with me once more. It's been a while since she's been on. Marjorie, well known for her writing on what is called the New Feminism, that is the feminism that stems from the legacy of St. John Paul the Great, St. John Paul II, and she's been really instrumental in formulating the basic principles of exactly what that new feminism is, and you can visit her website at www.newfeminism.co and see what she also writes for me at the Christian Review, and that's why I'm having her on today. Marjorie, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you, Deal. Thank you for having me.
You have written two columns for Christian Review that have gotten quite a bit of attention. One of which you came out in the middle of the campaign to respond to some prominent Catholic leaders who declared Donald Trump to be morally unfit to be president. It was entitled A Catholic Apology to Donald Trump. But recently you wrote one which is entitled A Christian Response to Anti-Trumpers. And let's talk about that, because that became something very personal for you, did it not?
It did, in a sort of surprising and unexpected way. I think many of us who became interested in the Trump-Pence campaign and the voter bloc of the Trump-Pence campaign have found ourselves over time kind of coming to an understanding of who that voter bloc was and why there was this groundswell of really unexpected support for Donald Trump. And as I came to understand and engage on social media about many of those Trump-related issues, I certainly got pushback. Many of the people in my circle, being from San Francisco, are consider themselves very progressive and very liberal, and were a little appalled that I would raise on social media even a curiosity about Donald Trump and who was voting for Donald Trump. But when my curiosity then evolved into actual support for the ticket, their pushback turned into more a form of hostility than a dialogue over differences. And on Inauguration Day, that hostility was expressed in a way that was quite a shock to me, Deal.
I can tell in your voice, you already, even in bringing it up, it still upsets you. But tell our listeners about it.
Well, I had been active in the Trump-Pence campaign through the Catholic National Advisor Group to the campaign. And as a result, I was very excited to have an opportunity to attend the inauguration festivities in Washington on January 20th. And my husband and I were walking around D.C. when my iPhone pinged, and there was a text message that arrived from a person who I consider my longest, dearest friend in life. And I've known her since high school, and we have followed different paths in life, but have been pretty careful to maintain the friendship and keep up with each other and spend time together. And the message read in part, "I am so sad today, realizing that our friendship is really over. I am in mourning for our country and in mourning over us. I do not want you part of my life." So it was...
And also, she was a painter, and she had given you some of her paintings?
Yes, she had. And I've had some of her paintings from very early on, including one that she did in high school. And I'm actually in the process of sending those early paintings back to her, Deal. She would like them back.
And this is pretty much without explanation, except for what you've already heard from her?
Yes, it was without explanation, except for what I had already heard from her, which was a very conclusory allegation that Trump is bad. He's a racist. He's all the isms that we've heard. And anyone who would support him just was a person who had, you know, evil objectives. And, you know, it's important to note, because as that article circulated both on social media and through the Christian Review, the number of comments that I received echoing the same sort of experience was pretty mind-boggling. Mine by no means was my interaction with my old friend a unique situation. And some of the comments that I read in the days following the article were just really heartbreaking, particularly ones where there were very long-term, very carefully tended family relationships that suddenly and unilaterally just terminated.
And your attempt to clarify exactly why this issue was so big to her, to break off a decades-old friendship, to take back paintings which were given from one friend to another, didn't get anywhere, did they?
No, it didn't. I asked her in response to just kind of take a step back and let's get together. Let's let this very historic moment and very emotional moment for a lot of people, let's let this calm down and let's plan on seeing each other. And I had also indicated to her that my mother is quite ill. She's in the final stages of dementia. And so I tried to focus our exchange on my mom and my mom's impending death, but to no avail.
The article you wrote in the Christian Review called "A Christian Response to Anti-Trumpers or Never-Trumpers" was really your own personal attempt to deal with your feelings in regard to this particular breakup. And I think your intention was to help the many people that we've heard from in response to your article, that they had experienced similar or just as bad breaks up within friendships and families.
Well, that's true, Deal. And I had heard some stories ahead of time, and I had actually intended, when I went to Washington to take a much more macro view of what was going on in Washington that week, because I attended both inauguration festivities and then also the Women's March the following day. And then I attended the March for Life the week later. And so I had really intended to sit down and sort of tease out some themes and comparisons and contrasts. And that just ended up not being the focus because it had become, for me, so personal. And as I talked with people who had had similar hurts, I realized that the level of emotion that was going on at a very micro level between people in very close relationships was really the story here. And as I said in the article, I actually refer to it as anti-Trumpism. Because I think it's an ism, like any of the other sort of destructive, knee-jerk kind of reactions that just do not invite dialogue and become an excuse for expressions of very strong, hostile emotion. As I said in the article, virulent anti-Trumpism seeks no dialogue, no understanding, and no rational exchange. It is as destructive and irrational as any other bigotry used to justify cruelty towards others. And I felt this was something important to say because a lot of people who have been and are being attacked in this way feel like they've done something wrong, or somehow they're responsible for the hostility that is being focused on them. So I felt that what our community could use, what I certainly could use, was a framework for handling this interaction.
And yeah, I think you set forth three basic principles, but at least things a person should think about as he or she is dealing with the pain of this kind of breakup.
Well, I did. As I reflected in the immediate minutes after my friend's text messages, I knew that I would forgive her and that I needed to forgive her. She and I have been interacting with each other for decades, and there have been many times when I've made mistakes or she's made mistakes and we've needed to forgive each other. So my first orientation was to keep that open as a possibility, as a goal, even if it would take some time and even if it was something she never sought. And then that really led me to my second conclusion, which was that I needed to remain loving and charitable in response to her. I'm the first one who makes the mistake of returning with quips and sarcasm, and if not those, then a longing to get into the merits of the debate. And I decided that it really was not going to be fruitful to do any of that, that this was a very emotional moment and a very emotional time, and that it would just make the situation worse and, in fact, continue the spiral of exchanging hostilities rather than kindness. So my second goal was to respond only in a way that was loving and charitable. But that doesn't mean that you beat yourself up. That doesn't mean I was going to beat myself up or that I was going to spend a tremendous amount of time trying to resolve the situation or solve her emotions. I have been, over the last 20 years of my life, very influenced by the works of Drs. Cloud and Townsend, who have written a series of books, the primer being called Boundaries. And so I knew I also now needed to set some boundaries. I spent, several days feeling wounded, and I also couldn't help but notice that she had chosen to deliver the sting right in the middle of the inauguration festivities. And she also chose to...
She wanted to spoil the party.
Well, it's certainly a possibility, Deal. And then when she ignored and disregarded any exchange about my mom, I recognized that this had gone to a level that was no longer... this had gone to a level where I was now thinking about it too much, if that makes sense. That may be more a female thing, but I started spinning and stewing and thinking through what exactly had I said that maybe had caused her to shut down the relationship, and I realized this is not about me. This is about her and the passion and her choice were not my problem. And so my third objective was now to set up some boundaries that would make sure I move on and she moves on, and give me some guidelines as to whether and under what conditions I would entertain communicating with her again. Does that make sense?
You and your husband and your kids, of course, they're out of the nest, but I have been residents of San Francisco for some years. So surely you faced this kind of thing before.
Neil, we have seen a lot of hostility in San Francisco. So, for example, in the early years, the West Coast Walk for Life was had levels of incidents of hostility such that we didn't take our young kids to it. There was a crudeness in the opposition, and frankly, there was some hostility and physical intimidation from the opposition that made it, in our judgment, an unhealthy environment for our little kids. But as they grew older, we started taking them. And the opposition also got a little bit worn out, particularly as the size of the crowd grew. But that said, that was really between strangers. That's more in the form of a protest. And while they could be quite nasty and very jarring in some of their chants and signs, that was between strangers. And I don't think I have seen in all the years that we have lived in San Francisco that sort of hostility invade the personal sphere like it has with the Trump-Pence victory. And that continues to remain a little bit of a puzzle to me, but I will tell you that it is so pronounced that there are people in San Francisco who I know for a fact supported Trump or voted for Trump or voted against Hillary, and they would never say so out loud. They would, they simply confided in me, often kind of in passing because I'm public and vocal, and they just want to give me a heads up that there are a lot of closet supporters. But the hostility towards Trump supporters really has taken a new form that I just haven't seen before.
There was an article posted on the Drudge Report just a few days ago that said that conservatives in San Francisco are actually taking measures to protect themselves, possible attacks. Is this really the case?
I don't know. I don't know about that. I haven't seen that level of threat except in the context of protests like the Berkeley protest. There's always been a underlying sense, proprietary sense by some number of the progressives and liberals that San Francisco is a special liberal enclave that belongs to them, and that conservatives, Republicans, religious people, all of the others don't even belong in the city. So, for example, my husband served on the San Francisco Republican Central Committee for a number of years and came home one day from a voter drive where they had set up a table at one of the local street fairs, and a couple of young adults had come over and spit on them and wiped everything off the table onto the ground and said something to the effect of, "What are you doing here? Republicans aren't welcome in San Francisco." And perhaps that kind of hostility is perhaps frightening to people who either haven't seen it before or are worried that they now might become targets of that.
Do you believe that there's something fundamentally has sort of cracked in the psyche of our nation? I mean, you and I are approximately the same age. I think I'm a little older. But I've never seen anything like this level of hatred. You actually have people publicly calling for violence against the president and his family. What do you think has happened to open up this kind of abyss?
Well, I've thought about this quite a bit, Deal. And for me, as I reflect on friends who are no longer speaking to me, for example, not just the friend we've been talking about, but people who I've played tennis with, who now have won't call to play tennis with me and won't even be friends on social media. I'm just blocked. I do think one of the things in my sphere that I've observed is that for many of these people, the legal statement of rights, of individual rights, has become a secular religion for them.
Mm-hmm. And an ultimate concern.
Right. So where for me, I derive my morality through the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church and the Judeo-Christian history that I am part of. And government and government's statements of morality, of social policy and what is right and what is wrong, never rise to the level for me of being a fundamental proposition that involved me and my identity. But I think for many of the people I know who are either atheists or agnostic or just simply do not have a religious practice that is in any way tied to their juxtaposition to the world, the last 8 years particularly has been almost at the level of a religious practice for them, as victory after victory after victory has accrued for, you know, transgender rights and gay rights and euthanasia and contraception and abortion. They have developed a sense that the right and moral positions are now stated by law. And because they've had so many victories and because their worldview lines up with these governmental positions, it just never occurred to them that these were actually debatable positions and that they were not right inherently, and they were not just inherently. And so there's almost a dizzying effect for some of these people as they watch their religion being basically being attacked. So
wasn't it rather foolish of them to think that such radical ideas could become the cultural norm within a decade?
Well, I think it's irrational, but the people that I know and who have such fidelity to these positions do not find it irrational at all. In fact, there is a very kind of familiar arrogance about it, where they feel very, very strongly that the intelligent, educated, secular elite have been able to steer the law and steer social practices a direction which only somebody unenlightened and uneducated would disagree with.
I'm talking with Marjorie Murphy Campbell, and if you put her name in a Google search engine, the first thing that comes up is her blog, www.newfeminism. And the third thing that comes up is an article she wrote for the Christian Review that I edit, Catholic Apology to Trump and His Voters. And a little further down, another article that she has written entitled A Christian Response to Anti-Trumpers. We'll be back with Marjorie Murphy Campbell in just a moment.
In 1967, college students seeking the Lord prayed for a new Pentecost. The Holy Spirit broke out amongst them, rippling throughout the world. The Amazing Grace Catholic Charismatic Conference will celebrate the power of the Spirit throughout these 50 years, February 17th through the 19th, at Eastern Michigan's Convocation Center. Go to www.dccr.info and click on Events for information. That's www.dccr.info.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak. Some couples do a better job of prioritizing their relationships than others, but a new study from the University of Illinois shows that all couples, even ones with a more don't-sweat-it attitude toward couple time, experience a greater risk of marital problems if they don't develop their relationship work ethic. According to the study, when people enter the workplace, they make an effort to arrive on time, be productive throughout the day, listen attentively to coworkers and supervisors, and try to get along with others. Researchers say couples should be at least as invested in their relationship work ethic, prioritizing their partner and putting the same kind of energy into active listening, planning time together, finding a workable solution for sharing household tasks, and handling personal stress so it doesn't spill over into the relationship. Our faith tells us that living our vocation as husbands and wives is the most important activity on our schedule. It seems science agrees. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
If you've enjoyed Father John Ricardo's gift of teaching and preaching in the past, his new book, Heaven Starts Now, is a book for you. In his inspiring and incisive way, Father John addresses the obstacles we all face in becoming mature disciples. How do we learn to forgive? How do we combat fear and understand suffering? How do we worship the Lord, love others, and surrender our lives to God? How do we become saints day by day? Order online at AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. That's AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab.
I'm back with Marjorie Murphy Campbell, and as I said when I introduced her, Marjorie's been one of the really key women in taking the writings, the legacy of St. John Paul II, John Paul the Great, and putting them in the form called New Feminism, which when people see it, they don't realize that this is not the pro-abortion, the abortion-centered feminism of Germain Greer and so forth. This is a feminism based upon the Catholic worldview, Catholic moral principles, Catholic understanding of human nature, on the dignity of women and their unique vocation. Marjorie, could you explain a little bit about that to our listeners?
You know, I think that new feminism has a much stronger intellectual foundation than a lot of people realize. Proponents of the new feminism like Pia De Cellini and Elizabeth Fox Genovese and Colleen Carroll Campbell, and even yourself, picked up some time ago the work being done by St. John Paul, and with specifically with a lot of attention to the complementarity principle. The complementarity principle being that men and women are equal but different, and that women have a unique gift, which St. John Paul called the feminine genius, or the genius of women. And that that unique gift contributes not only to the holiness and functionality of a family, but it contributes, if it's being exercised and recognized in a healthy way, it contributes to the very spiritual health of the community and even the larger entities at the state and country level. And the new feminism, one of the interesting things for me about coming into the new feminism was that many of the proponents, or I should say the one who had the most influence on me, Elizabeth Fox Genovese, actually started out where I started out, and that is in our early years being away from the Catholic Church, away from a religious program, and quite active as radical feminists within the late 20th century radical feminist movement. And that feminism, which was on amazing display at the Women's March on January 22nd, I believe, has really come to sort of a dead end. And I'm very hopeful that the beautiful groundwork that has been laid intellectually will now get more publicity, more recognition, and provide a language for discussing what is missing in our families and in our communities.
Do you think that yourself and the other distinguished women that you mentioned, especially Elizabeth Fox Genovese, who I was privileged to know when I was a graduate student at Emory University, have had much success in getting to this millennial generation or any of the younger generations that we've had so much trouble evangelizing to?
That's an interesting question, D.L. I don't think that the intellectual work has reached them, but I think that there is within the younger generation of women a growing recognition that their set of expectations and their set of measures for who they are as people and what their paths, what the options are for fulfilling their lives, that those expectations and paths have been restrained by a form of feminism that seems rather patriarchal. And what I mean by that is that many of these young women are looking and wondering aloud why it is that their success is defined in the exact same way male capitalist success has always been defined. The job, the pay level, the rate of advancement, and that the focus on these measures of success are creating tremendous dissonance for young women who actually really like the idea of getting married and really like the idea of having children and like the idea of raising a family, and finding themselves quite unfulfilled by the male measure of their success as young professionals and starting off in the workplace.
So what do you're saying that there's been moderate success? I know it's found its way into the classrooms at places like Franciscan University in Christendom and some of the Orthodox schools. Do you think you've made inroads beyond that?
I think that in the Catholic colleges, particularly where we have some of the young, dynamic Catholic law professors who are both law professors and regular professors in the humanities who are introducing this material into the curriculum, yeah, I think that that's been successful. The problem is cracking the nut at the traditional secular colleges where there is such a lock on the women's studies programs and the humanities programs that it's most of these people would never have even heard of Elizabeth Fox Genovese, who was practically blackballed by the feminists when she converted to Catholicism. But what I'm suggesting is that even without an intellectual understanding or an intellectual basis for framing their objections, there are a lot of young women who are not buying the feminist package. I was very surprised at the Women's March, for example, at how old the crowd was. If you compare the age of the crowd at the March for Life in D.C.
Right.
with the age of the crowd at the Women's March, I would imagine the average age was at least two decades apart. And there was a just huge swelling of 50, 60, 70-year-old women with gray hair like mine walking around in their pussy hat and chanting, you know, very obnoxious, horrible mantras and terribly sex-suggestive signs. But it was not predominantly young women. And at the March for Life, on the other hand, it was a very, very young, vibrant group of people, both young women and young men. So I think that there's some sentiment out there that is looking for explanations and looking for rationale to hang the opinions on. And I'll give you an example of this. In the area of birth control pills. You know, the birth control pill is sort of in the late 20th century feminism, just an absolute, untouchable, almost sacred symbol of feminism. And today, you have very significant numbers of young women who are actively tending their bodies through organic food and organic eating and caring for their bodies with exercise and yoga and meditation. And many of them are now wondering why it is that they're taking artificial hormones every day in order to treat fertility as if it was a disease.
As an enemy.
As an enemy, and with the consequences to the environment that are, if it was anything else, they would be very opposed. They'd object wholeheartedly. And I think the more we can, as women of faith and as women within the new feminism movement, help match those concerns to the intellectual underpinning of new feminism, the more it will help these young women be able to figure out why it is this is bugging them. So I'm very in favor of a Catholic green movement that's, you know, body green. And we approach this younger generation with what we know to be a much healthier, healthful lifestyle and care of their bodies.
I have an odd question. Do you think that Trump-Pence ticket actually appealed to this kind of woman more than the Clinton-Kane ticket did?
That's an interesting question. I think a lot of these women were Bernie Sanders supporters. I think a lot of them were looking for a shakeup of the feminism paradigm, but that they really saw Bernie Sanders as their best choice. I think that Hillary Clinton was incredibly unappealing. And between her kind of history with her own husband and her hostility towards the women that she targeted because of their involvement with him, and I think also the notion that Madeleine Albright insisted upon that only there's a special place in hell for women who don't vote for women. I don't think this reached the young women of the millennium generation. Now, whether they opted not to vote or whether many of them secretly voted for Trump, I don't know.
But there was a very appealing potential first lady in Melania Trump. Do you think that she had a positive impact on women voters?
Well, I think that she did, but I think even more than her, Ivanka had an incredible impact on the young women.
She has
really modeled poise, grace, fashion, family, success, involvement. It's hard to imagine a young woman looking at that and not thinking, oh, so that's what it looks like to have it all.
Right. And she's a convert to Orthodox Judaism, correct?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Which says a lot about her, I mean, in a good way, I think. That she wanted her family to be united, and united in a faith that has the moral teaching has entirely in common with Orthodox Catholics and Evangelicals.
Well, I think that's right, Gil, and I think it also demonstrates to the younger generations that discipline in family life and discipline in sexual life is just as important as discipline in the gym. These are all young people who completely understand the idea that working out is not, in fact, I've made this argument with any number of my children's friends who visit us and come through our home who are all very disciplined about getting to the gym. They're disciplined about the food they eat, but they are not disciplined about their spiritual lives and about their social behavior. And it's always a fun conversation to see why they think discipline is worthwhile and fruitful and productive in some areas of human life, but in other areas we get a pass. And I think that Ivanka is just a marvelous role model for discipline in all areas of life.
She, and now she seems to be receiving retribution in terms of her product line at various retail stores.
That seems to be the case. I don't really know what to make of that, but I feel pretty certain that people who would like to buy Ivanka Trump's line will be able to find it at some point. And many of these retailers may end up reconsidering just how far they want to go, participating in the boycott mentality instead of just focusing on their business and their service to all customers. I'm hoping it's a blip.
Well, you know, I wrote to Nordstrom's, where I've shopped, and Teresa, my wife, has shopped for many, many years, and said they lost my business, and they came back and said that this was due to sales. Well, the problem is they had radical left feminists protesting loudly in front of their New York store for several weeks, and for them to make that announcement in the midst of that makes it look to the general public like they were agreeing with the protesters and all the things the protesters were saying, which were extremely nasty.
I agree with that, Neil. And it's also in the midst of a very active, well-funded boycott campaign where there are organized efforts to slowly but surely target retailers and force them through threats and intimidation to drop lines of products. I think I read the next one is Amazon carries Trump suits, and they are now focused on getting Amazon to drop Trump's line of suits.
I didn't even know Donald Trump had a line of suits.
I didn't either, and I certainly didn't know Amazon. I've never bought a suit on Amazon, so
I think his suits could actually be improved myself.
We would all respect that opinion.
But with Ivanka and Melania, there's no improvement needed. Or with the kids, for that matter.
Yeah. My daughter sent me a photograph day before yesterday. Ivanka was sitting on a ledge in a walkway in the White House, and she had one of her little children on her lap, and then he was trying to do the crawl up mommy thing. Meanwhile, she's sitting talking on the telephone, and some photographer got a picture of this, and she's dressed impeccably. And my daughter sent me this photograph and said, "This is perfect, Mom."
Yes, and it really is reminiscent of the impact that John F. and Jackie Kennedy had on the American public.
Yes.
Are you old enough to remember that?
Of course. Of course, I'm just not sure what we were seeing at the time was...
Well, I'm talking about in terms of style and you know, how to present oneself to the general public.
Yes.
Which is very, very positive, I think. Of course, John F. Kennedy did destroy men's hats completely.
I have to tell you, I am very glad I went to the Women's March after the inauguration. And the contrast between being part of a very formal event, including the balls the evening of the inauguration, and the care with which people dressed for the balls and presented themselves and the sort of interaction people were having with each other, compared with the following day and the focus of so many of the protesters at the Women's March.
How bad was it out there?
Deal, I was quickly aware that this was not a Women's March. This was an anti-Trump march. And so it was bad because the anti-Trumpism was unleashed. And the attempt to sell this march as having something or anything to do with women, I think, was very successful in the media. But for those of us who were in attendance, it was abundantly clear that the march was just meant to bring together anybody who wanted to display their anti-Trumpism. And the Pussy Hat Project, which was, it became very much a part of the march, but not part of the original design of the march, was probably one of the most offensive, crass and crude things I've seen in my lifetime. I've written on that project in, at newfeminism.co. And I've received comments from people, there's one fellow from Australia, another person from Canada, and all of them were pretty consistent comments that it was appalling to them to see the display of such female self-deprecation, and that it made it very hard to take that protest and those marchers seriously.
Well, I guess I thought about going out there, but I thought I'd get myself in trouble. You know, I'd say something or do something, and then I'd be on TV and being shoved and pushed and kicked or something, and I decided not to go.
Well, Deal, you would have had to dress down, that's for sure. You couldn't just come out there in a full attire.
No, if I was coming, I was coming out fully feathered, believe me.
I have to assure you, I fit right in. I was in my blue jeans, and I have my salt and pepper hair and my kind of old-fashioned glasses and hoop earrings, so I was quite safe.
We're from here now. We have an opportunity with a new president, pro-life president. We have pro-life party in charge of both houses of Congress. I mean, where do you think we need to push? Where do you think we need to educate?
On the dignity of the human person. I believe we can pull together the threads on these social issues and present an easy-to-understand, sweeping picture that works domestically and globally on the dignity of the human person. Unfortunately, so many of these issues have become very fragmented. So you have one group working on immigration issues. You have another group working on human trafficking. You have another group working on international issues involving starvation and food and access to water.
Which all come together under the rubric of human dignity.
Yes, they do. And I am very hopeful. He's only got 4 years, and I know the clock is ticking, and I know the Democrat strategy to keep him and keep this administration tied up as long as possible in sheer matters of bureaucracy. But I am hopeful that once he gets everybody appointed and he has a full working team, we're going to see some simplification and some very beautiful joinder of issues under the rubric of human dignity.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show today once again. I'm a good friend and ally, fellow warrior, Marjorie Murphy Campbell. And go visit New Feminism. You'll find some very, very good articles. And really, that website, which was begun in 2012, was one of the first to be entirely devoted to connecting the legacy of John Paul II, St. John Paul, to the notion of what a woman really is in her unique vocation. So thanks again for being a guest with me on Church and Culture.
Thank you so much, Deal, and I just encourage everybody to stay active, stay involved. These are exciting times that we're in.
Yes, and I would say we have a unique opportunity to turn our country around. For all of you who are listening, please join me this time, this day, next week. And Marjorie, once again, thank you.
you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net. Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, Chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
Jesus is teaching his disciples, "Don't think I've come to abolish the law or prophets. I've come to fulfill them. I tell you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. You've heard that it was said to your ancestors, 'You shall not kill. Whoever kills shall be liable to judgment.' But I say to you, whoever is angry with a brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever says 'you fool' will be liable to fiery Gehenna. If you bring your gift to the altar and there recall your brother has anything against you, leave your gift there at the altar, be reconciled with your brother, and then come and offer your gift." Now we need to hear that. Many families have feuds, and people need to sort them out before they come to Mass and Communion. You know, it was said you should not commit adultery, but I say to you, and here Jesus is setting himself up as the Moses of the new Israel, everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out. It's better to be blind than to be thrown into Gehenna. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Jesus is calling us to live a sin-free life. So I need to ask you, how well are you doing on this? If not, get to confession. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read today at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
How important was unity to Jesus Christ? Very, according to the Catholic Catechism. He bestowed unity on his church at the outset. It is something the church can never lose, but with prayer and work, she can improve. This is why, the Catholic Catechism says, Jesus himself prayed at the hour of his passion and continues praying, that they may all be one. As you, Father, are in me and I in you, may they also be one in us. The Catechism further states, the desire to recover the unity of all Christians is a gift of Christ and a call of the Holy Spirit. The Catechism says there are certain things required in order to respond adequately to this call: a permanent renewal of the Church, conversion of the heart, prayer in common, fraternal knowledge of each other, ecumenical formation, dialogue among theologians and Christians, collaboration in good works. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. You may be Catholic today merely because your family is Irish or Italian or from the Philippines. Going to Mass is what you do because your family has always done it. But being a member of the body of Christ is so much more than a cultural or ethnic identity. Being a son or daughter of the King of the Universe is so much more than something you do. It is who you are, and it goes to the deepest level of your identity and your reason for existing. God wants to draw us into his family.